man with the game information. Gaming Steve, Gaming Steve. Xbox, Nintendo, PC, or PlayStation. Gaming Steve, Gaming Steve. Giving the news to the nerd generation. Gaming Steve. Give me news.
Give me news.
Give me views.
Give me views.
Gaming Steve.
Gaming Steve. He got the game.
What's to see?
What's to see?
What's to me?
What's to me?
Gaming Steve.
Gaming Steve. He got the game.
Tell me how. Tell me now.
Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for the hardest working man in the game industry, the one-man vortex of gaming information, the man who is Gordon Freeman's thesis advisor at MIT. Ladies and gentlemen, Gaming Steve!
Hey, this is Gaming Steve coming to you from day three of Game Developers Conference, and I have quite an exquisite roundtable today. Instead of myself introducing it, let's go around.
Hey, this is Brent from VirginWorlds.com MMORPG podcast.
My name is Michael Zanke. I write for Slashdot and Massively.com.
Hey, this is Mike Shapiro. I'm a composer for games and film, and I wrote the Gaming Steve theme song, which I don't even know if he's still using, but I wrote he's still using it, apparently, so that's mine.
Yes, the infamous Gaming Steve game, the theme song. So today was a recap. I just want to go around and see what you guys thought of the show for the day and what things you saw that you thought were interesting or and whatnot. I myself, you know, one of the things I, of course, wanted to see really badly was the Portal talk. But, of course, the line was around the entire convention hall, so I didn't quite get a chance to see that. In fact, I didn't get to see it at all. But I did see a few other things. Well, why don't I go around to see if there was anything that tickled your fancy?
The thing that leapt out at me most today was probably the one that we went to together, the Maid Marian Entertainment. It's an MMO that runs in Shockwave in a browser. And one guy built the entire thing, and he's got 1.8 million users. That's a lot.
Yeah, no, I was actually blown away, because this thing is a full 3D world that runs inside of a browser that looks, you know, I mean, it's not a WoW level, but it could be a WoW-type game, and he's got, you know, 1.8 million users, and he developed it by himself, him and his wife. That's it. That's entire staff, and he did all artwork, all programming. He manages it. He does the customer support, every single aspect of the game, and it's I mean, it's pretty mind-boggling, but it also shows you that, you know, you hear about these MMOs that cost $75, $100 million to make, and even small ones to make $20 to $40 million to make, and here's this guy doing it with him and his wife and doing really well and destroying pretty much all the other big-name MMOs when it comes to numbers.
Yeah, the thing is that the thing that makes it really difficult is that not very many people have that much talent wrapped up in a single body in order to do it. He didn't spend any money really building it at all. He had a copy of Maya, and that's about it. He claims to be a hack as a programmer, but clearly if you write that sort of client-server architecture and use Shockwave, which is not really custom-built for building a 3D MMO, he knew what he was doing. But he's got all the skills. I mean, he did all the art himself. That's a multi-talented individual.
Yeah, and what's also interesting is that there was a couple of, you know, he mentioned a few others. I don't know if you have your notes, but he rattled off a few others that are also trying to do that. He demonstrated one or two of other, like, small MMOs, 3D environments that are being done by, like, one or two people. So it seems like, you know, there's sort of, you know, we're talking about indie games, and indie games really did a lot this year, you know, with the success of Portal, which kind of started out as an indie game. And now we're starting to see indie game MMOs, which you would never think was even possible a few years ago.
I didn't get to see the talk, but the thing I find really interesting about that is, you know, there's all these companies that are coming up with third-party solutions for platforms. Multiverse is one of them, Big World's another one, and I think it's kind of fascinating that companies are starting to see room for small MMOs, because like I said, I mean, that's just, it's a concept that I don't think a lot of people even think about when they think about massive multiplayer games.
Yeah, you think massively multiplayer, so it's got to be massive, and you think, you know, and quite frankly they do. I mean, I found not only the game interesting, but one person I asked a question, and he said, well, what do you do about customer support? Because I talked to the guys at Blizzard, and that is their biggest, the most amount of employees they have is customer support by far. I mean, they have thousands and thousands of people doing nothing but customer support, DMs, GMs, you know, helping people out. And he said, well, it's free, so you get what you pay for. You know, it's like if people write me emails, I try to write them back. And I found it fascinating that he's able to run a game with millions of people all by himself on every level. And it doesn't seem like he was stressed out at all. Or it seemed like he even, he said, oh, it took a month off vacation and only worked a few hours a day, and yet has 1.8 million people playing this thing.
Seems like it would be a pretty nice job to have. He said that he started out as a hobby while he was doing other work, and this guy's an experienced developer. I mean, he's been in the business a long time. He was an art director, I believe, for a number of titles, and he did it on the side, and eventually the ad revenue, which is how he makes money doing it, he just puts an ad at the bottom of the game, that money that he's making off of that surpassed his actual earnings. And so he said, well, I guess I might as well not go to work anymore. And that seems like a pretty good choice. And you're right, it's amazing that he doesn't have more customer support problems or more of a, you know, an infrastructure based on the fact that he's got 1.8 million people going to his website or playing his game every month. But I guess with that sort of game, since he's not actually billing people anything, he's not going to have people calling up and saying, hey, I was double billed or I wasn't billed or anything like that. He doesn't have to worry about fraud or credit card transactions, which does make it a lot easier. And frankly, it's a browser-based Shockwave app. If it doesn't work, it's probably user error.
Yeah, no, probably. But no, I was really impressed with this. I'm going to try it out and give it a try. You know, it's like you hear about RuneScape and you hear about all some of these others, but you know, most, and he was saying this is like the 2D or 2.5D MMOs are very popular. But this was the first time I really saw a true 3D MMO that's a small MMO that actually looked good. You know, a lot of these look kind of like crap, quite frankly, you know, I'll be honest. And this one actually looked really professional. And that was another question, audience. Someone asked him, where'd you get all your art assets from? Because it looked amazing. And he said he did them all. He didn't even use libraries. I mean, this is a rare talent. This is a guy who can do a little bit of everything. And these type of people are pretty rare in this industry, let alone in MMO industry. So, but what else did you guys see? Anything interesting?
Well, the thing that I saw today that I guess took note of the most, because today was kind of a slow day for me, was Chronicles of Spellborn. I went over to check that out at the Germany Pavilion, and I have to say, I mean, I've heard about Chronicles for a long time. I mean, it's been in development for quite some time now. And so when I went in, I was hoping that I'd see something there that would make me excited, because they've got a pretty good idea, right? So your equipment doesn't have anything to do with your stats. All your stats are based on abilities and skills you pick up as you level. And what you look like is completely independent from your powers. So you can stylize your character any way you want. And the crafting system's based off that too, where you fight a guy and basically he gives you a broken item that looks like the thing that the mob was wearing, and then you can have it fixed, and then you can wear the item. So, I mean, it's not a bad idea. But, I mean, in nowadays with World of Warcraft to compare to and these other games that are trying to reach the mass market, it's just so hardcore that it's hard to believe that it's going to find any kind of wide success. If it makes 125,000 subscriptions, I think it'll be a big deal for it. And so it's just kind of a shame to me personally, because they have some really good ideas there, especially the equipment thing. But I just don't think that in today's marketplace, they're going to find the kind of success they need to make the investment they put into it worth it.
Is that game out yet in Germany, or is it?
No, I don't think it's out. I think it's coming out later. It's supposed to actually release later this year, which is good because it's been in development for almost like 4 years, I think. It's been... Oh,
4 years for an MMO is not that outrageous.
Yeah, but I mean, I've been hearing about Chronicles of Spellborn since back... Oh, no, I'm sorry. It'd have to be longer than that, because I've been hearing about Chronicles of Spellborn back when I was doing volunteer writing about massive games, which was like 6 years ago. So it's more like 6 years than four, apparently.
Yikes. Yeah, I don't know much about the game, which is surprising. Usually I hear about all these, but no, that one I haven't heard anything about except for, you know, with the rumors and, you know, hearing about it a lot, and then this sort of faded from, you know, the press, and I didn't even know they were here. I definitely would have checked that out. What did you think of it, Brent? Did you see it? Or?
Yeah, I have seen it, and it's one of those games that I really want to like a lot because they've got a lot of great ideas. They didn't try to make their game super realistic looking. They made a very, very cool stylized art style, and it's not like anything you've probably seen before. I guess you could say it's a little bit like maybe Saga of Rhizome, which was sort of a niche European MMO, but it's not quite that crazy. But it looks great. So I really want to like it, but it kind of feels like more of the same. Because it was been in development for, you know, 4 years or something, it's coming off on the heels of, you know, things like World of Warcraft, or before World of Warcraft was even out, which means that it's probably gone through a lot of iterative development, saying, okay, what did the MMOs since then release do differently that we need to pick up? And now there's a new standard to match, right? And they started development before that new standard was set. every year it gets harder and harder. They can't just, and I heard somebody say this in a session this week, they can't just match what World of Warcraft had the day it came out. They have to match what World of Warcraft has today and later this year and next year. It's very difficult. So unfortunately, I agree with Michael. I don't think the game's going to do real well, but I really do respect what they built.
Yeah, that was actually in the MMO talk. They were saying that you have to, you can't just match the set of tools and the game experience of what World of Warcraft was from day one. You have to match what it is now with everything, including the expansions and what EverQuest can give you with all the expansions, because that's really the playing field. And every year it's getting tougher and tougher and tougher. But yet, these people keep coming out with these MMOs. I mean, you hear about a lot of them dying. The Marvel one, I was kind of surprised to hear about. Actually, I was stunned to hear that one got killed, because that seemed like an absolute no-brainer. They have Cryptic working on it, who loves the Marvel universe. Jack was like a huge Marvel fan. I was stunned to hear that was canceled. But in theory, the Champions one should be very good. The Champion system is a brilliant system if they manage to implement it correctly. But I definitely want to. And I trust Jack because he knows what he's doing and he loves comics. But I'm also hesitant because I've heard a couple of negative things too.
All that stuff about World of Warcraft and then Jack's kind of enthusiasm, we kind of saw yesterday at the Future of MMOs panel, which was probably my personal highlight, just because it's not very often you get to see such people as Min Kim, Rob Pardo, Matt Miller from NCSoft, Jack Emmert, and Ray Muscaya,
right.
All on one stage together. I mean, the smart in that room alone. And then they all argued, and it was hilarious. So, I mean, it was a good time. And why don't we ask Brent what he thinks of Champions? Because,
Brent, I heard you have an opinion or two on this.
Well, I don't know much about Champions itself, but I will admit that when I heard that Cryptic and Jack were going to make another heroic MMO, I said, really? Isn't that market, kind of done? I mean, they already built what I would consider sort of the pinnacle of superhero MMOs. I mean, they built City of Heroes, right? It's great. There's nothing wrong with that game. It's doing very well today. City of Villains followed it up nicely, added that flip side to the coin, and then they let it go to NCSoft. I don't know the exact scenario of why that occurred, but they let it go. It's out of their hands now, and now they're going to turn around and do it again. Now I'm thinking they're going to be able to do something fancy, something better, something they didn't do the first time around. They've learned things, but not only have they already figured out that two major organizations, being Microsoft and Marvel, didn't want to go that route and try to compete. They're going to try to go at it with a different IP, starting from scratch again, on their own. I imagine they're funded by somebody, but they don't have a publisher attached to this one that I know of. And they've got to contend with DC, which SOE is working on. And that one's definitely going to happen, and that one is looking pretty interesting.
Well, Champions does have a big fan base, but it has a big hardcore fan base, while DC and Marvel has, I mean, you don't have to talk about it. I mean, they have a gigantic fan base. And to be honest, the way Marvel Comics, I follow them pretty closely since I own the stock, and what they do is they're becoming an IP company. They don't do comics anymore. They sell IPs. They make video games themselves. They make movies themselves. They're licensing out their IPs to make money, which is what Disney basically survives on, and DC is going to go that route too. So, can this game, Champions game, exist on gameplay mechanics and the idea of playing a superhero and Cryptic's reputation alone? I don't know. I think it can, but I don't think it's going to get World of Warcraft numbers. I think it'll probably get 100,000, 200,000 numbers.
I think that's a really good point about Marvel and DC, because, I mean, those companies aren't even, as you say, about comics anymore, because their characters have such cultural cachet in America that, people know Spider-Man, they know Superman, so if those games come out, people will actually gravitate to them just because of the stories they've read in movies and stuff.
Come on, Mike. How about you? I know you're a big comic book fan, so we got to throw something in here.
I am, but I'm not on the cutting edge of MMO development. I can talk to you about some cool audio talks if that's of interest. But
okay, we'll jump to that, because I think we're geeking out a little bit on MMO. So how about that? Why don't you tell me some of the cool audio talks you saw, or what do you think about the procedural music and Spore? Because I know you're on that talk.
What an excellent segue. That was, in fact, the audio talk that I found most exciting. The music in Spore is cool because it's, as you said, procedural, which means it's dynamically generated in accordance with a template. So it's not canned and looping, but it's not completely random either. It's generated by a kind of system that pays attention to what's going on in the game. So Spore is about customization, and the music is actually subtly tailored to reflect the kind of race you build or the kind of creature. So if you have a very warlike race, the music becomes apparently more aggressive, and if it's a more religious race, it takes on a more spiritual tone. And it seems like they've really got this down. This has been sort of an elusive, cutting-edge frontier element of game music. And in the past, procedural music has been kind of like listening to all the slot machines in Vegas. You know, it's kind of music, but it's sort of this tumult. And what I heard was really impressive, so I'm looking forward to seeing it in action.
No, I was actually stunned. And they only did that with two developers. They had two guys, one full-time, one like a part-time grad student. And you know Brian?
I'm not remembering the names, but I do want to point out they were using a really powerful tool that did pre-exist, this thing called, I think, PD, and they tweaked a little bit, and that was this very flexible programming language just for audio, and they really used that. They got a lot of mileage out of that to make such a flexible system.
But I was impressed just even the, not only were they doing that, but the type of music. So like when you're doing the tribal stage, there was a lot of drum beats. When you're doing the science, you know, when you're doing the UFO stage, it sounded more science fiction-y. You know, it was actually customizing the music procedurally to, you know, reflect the type of place you're in the game, as well as the type of creature and game you're playing, which sounds incredibly ambitious and totally ridiculous and impossible to do, but yet it's Will Wright's team in Spore, so they are, you know, it's, so you have to give them, you know, a benefit of the doubt, and quite frankly, we saw it working, and I thought it was pretty unbelievable. It seemed so easy for them.
I was really impressed, and it seems their secret is taking a small number of elements and then combining them in a large number of ways. They're not trying to do something tremendously ambitious, but they can take a couple of percussion sounds and come up with an interesting way of cycling through them and tweaking them so that they're relevant to whatever race you are, and getting really interesting and surprisingly musical results, which, again, is not something everyone has been able to tackle with effectively in the past.
So, like, traditionally, I mean, since you actually do game development, sound for game development, Empire Earth 2 and 3 were some of the products that you did, you know, how is it traditionally done? Is everything pre-canned? Do you ever, I know you were talking a little bit about Empire Earth 3 had some dynamic elements to it.
We did, but what we did, what was called reactive or adaptive music, where we have musical elements that are prefabricated and we recombined them, and so we might have layers, and light combat might have two musical layers, and then intense combat might have three or four musical layers, but it's all the same prepackaged elements. What Spore is doing is what's sometimes called generative music, where you're really synthesizing it from ground up, note for note. As far as I can tell, they weren't using pre-recorded musical chunks, or at least not in the stuff we saw. And that's what's impressive, is they're really starting from scratch and building larger scale musical entities from small pieces.
Yeah, it was a weird talk because, you know, man, I went to it just because it was Spore, and I didn't know what to expect. But I found it, you know, strangely fascinating from a completely different standpoint, not even from the Spore standpoint, but just like what they were actually accomplishing from a technical standpoint.
There's a real practical value, too, because a game like this is persistent. So you're going to be playing it for hours and hours and hours. And if this music ever loops, you're going to know it and be sick to death of it. I've played games where I've turned off my own music because it looped too many times. So it's a real issue. And coming up with something that creates new music that's kind of all feels cut from the same cloth but is not literally the same, I think, is a really intelligent approach.
So you think this is going to be the start of, oh, you know, what you're going to be seeing in other games, you know, if this succeeds?
I think for persistent games that are long-form experiences, there's a lot of application for this. For games that are more story-oriented and more constrained and maybe not that long, the traditional approach may work better.
Which brings me back to MMOs, because that is the definition of an MMO. It's like you spend hundreds/thousands of hours, and I can't imagine. I hear all the time people play my podcast while they're playing MMOs. It's very common, you know. It's because they turn off the music, they turn off chat, you know, and they listen to podcasts or they listen to their own music. They actually don't, you know, they don't want to hear the music for the millionth, billionth time. So I can see that being used pretty quickly, actually. And it seems like, especially the way they set this up, it seemed not impossible or not incredibly difficult, not easy to implement, but it didn't seem like it was it was something that was reachable in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I think this will serve as a real proof of concept for this sort of thing, because I know that they were a little shaky on the idea, and Brian Eno, of all people, got involved with the project and apparently convinced them that it would work, and thus emboldened, they seem to have accomplished something very cool.
But the only thing is, are you now going to have to become a programmer / music composer? I mean, I know you are, but, you know, what about other people?
It doesn't bother me. Again, I think when you have cases where the game is more story-oriented, where you have specific characters and there isn't so much of a focus on end-user generation of the story, the traditional approach is going to be more important. Ultimately, handcrafted music is going to have the biggest emotional impact. I don't think that dynamically, you know, melody is a real key element of music. And if you want something ambient that is kind of just going on and on and on, this stuff is great. And if you want a theme, you know, sort of the John Williams leitmotif school, where you want a recognizable theme for a character, I wouldn't, at the state of technology now, trust a computer to come up with something that I ever wanted to listen to. So I wouldn't, you know, if you're a traditional composer and you're not down with algorithmic compositional tools, I wouldn't go scrambling for a day job. I think there's going to be room for both approaches for a long time.
Yeah, I just wanted to chip in and say that I'm definitely not a composer, but like the music from Massively Multiplayer Games, even though I turn it off, I listen to it all the time on my iPod. The music of Jeremy Soule and Jason Hayes and those people is just really compelling. And I definitely hope that while I can see a place for generative music in especially Massively Multiplayer Games, I definitely hope, you know, why would you want to lose the theme, a great theme like the World of Warcraft theme? I mean, it's so iconic, you know?
I was just thinking, well, for one, that's amazing technology, but I was also thinking that we just found a host for a games and music podcast, because that was really well done.
Ah. Oh, I see. So Mike Shapiro, you mean now, so that's your, like, your 19th podcast now, or?
No, I don't know if it's necessarily for virtual worlds, but hey, call me.
See, that's the whole point of GDC. You connect with people, you get jobs. It's true. You really do. So was there anything else? I saw the rant. This is this got a lot of press last year, the game developers rant, where, you know, famous game designers actually go up and, like, complain about what's wrong with gaming today, and I actually didn't think it was as ranty as usual, because, you know what, every year I'm starting to see this, like, one of the big things that people have been complaining about, especially last year, was like, oh, you know, games aren't indie enough and we're not doing indie games. But then this year, you know, last year with, you know, Portal winning everything and indie games really coming into their own, and, you know, with the Wii being so popular, it's hard to complain about indie games, because, you know, this is it's being taken very, very seriously, especially with WiiWare being announced and XNA and the PlayStation 3. It's like every major platform is embracing that. So it seemed like what they're really complaining about now was more important, like how we're being seen in the industry. But that's something that I think you can't really do much about. I think it will just naturally occur, because right now, most gamers are in their, I would say the oldest gamers are in their late 30s, early 40s. But as gaming matures and as we get older, we will get into more positions of power. It sounds weird, but, like, you know, people that are, oh, I don't know, you know, like, judges will actually be gamers, and they will be able to then, you know, take cases against, you know, like that Jack Thompson would come up and actually, instead of them, you know, not knowing what he's talking about, saying, you know what, I'm a lifelong gamer, I've played games and I'm a judge, so I know what you're talking about, and this is utter, you know, this is utter BS, I'm throwing this out. And I think just over time this will hopefully naturally evolve. But I did find it interesting that here we are, an $18 billion industry. We destroyed movies last year. We destroyed music last year. And this industry really gets no respect still. And yet we're much bigger than these other mass culture industries. We're bigger than TV. We're bigger than everyone, really. There's very few industries as big as this, and yet we're considered almost ghetto.
Well, the thing that keeps getting driven home for me is that, you know, the politicians this year are lining up to get the presidency, and they're also lining up to take a knock at games. Pretty much everyone who's a major political candidate in the presidential race this year has made some sort of smarmy remark about, you know, people sitting on couches playing Xbox, or Hillary Clinton obviously is the most obvious person, having actually gone so far as to try to craft legislation around the subject. But all of them have taken cheap shots at gaming, because it's an easy political target today. I definitely agree that there's a lot of work to be done there.
I mean, one thing I would say is that I went to a Toy Fair right before this in New York. And Toy Fair, if you're not familiar with it, it's very much like GDC. It's a huge convention in New York where they talk about, they show off the latest toys and the latest toy figurines and such that they're going to be out for Christmas. And I went to a couple of meetings, and I dress pretty much always the same. I have a button-down shirt and khaki pants, and I was by far the least dressed person there. And this is for toys. Everyone's wearing suits and ties. All the women are dressed in, you know, business suits. And I was easily, by far, no one was dressed as poorly as I was. On the other hand, I come to Game Developers Conference, I'm wearing the exact same thing. I'm wearing a button-down shirt and khakis, and I am by far the most overdressed person here. You know, I mean, if everyone here is wearing jeans and T-shirts, and these aren't like, a developer. This is like the CEO of some of these companies.
Absolutely. In fact, I always look at my outfit, and this is coming from you, Steve. You always say, just a little bit sharper than your average gamer, because otherwise you kind of blend in, and you, when you're pressed, you want to dress nice, right? And so I tried to make an effort, but after being here for a few years now, I was like, well, you know what? I'm going to wear a shirt that doesn't have any logos on it, something nice and pressed, and a pair of jeans, because that's pretty much what everyone wears. And one of the podcasters that came with from Virgin Worlds, he wanted to dress up, and he wore khakis, and he wore a tie and a button-down shirt the first day. And we were down on the floor, and a bunch of the people we were talking to were saying, why are you wearing a tie?
You know, but it's a subtle thing. But you know what? I think it's also a self-image. It's like, it's like we see ourselves almost like as a kind of a kid. Oh, you know, we're not a serious industry, but we are. I mean, it's like you're trying to have it both ways. And so they complain about us not being taken seriously in mass media in America, but yet they also want to, like, you know, sleep till noon and like dress like slobs and act like teenagers all the time.
I think one element contributing to it as well is that I think there's more of a meritocracy in the gaming culture. You know, if you're really good, you get respect, and it doesn't matter if you come in dressed like a barrel as much as it would in traditional business, where, you know, image has much more importance. And I'm not saying it doesn't have any importance. You'll still see the top execs dressed in a business suit, but I think you can have a lot of respect and still dress completely casually just because there's more appreciation for actual talent.
One thing I do notice is that there's a lot of people come from over in Asia to come over to GDC, and they are all dressed really, really sharp. In fact, they're always in coats and nice slacks, and I mean, they're dressed up.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely. There's a lot of foreigners here from all countries, and they always dress quite well. You know, you don't see them in jeans and sneakers ever, really. And I just wonder, you know, it's like, are we almost sabotaging ourselves? It's like, I know it's a casual industry and you're making games, but you know what? There comes to a point where you have to realize that these games are costing millions and millions of dollars. And on top of that, they're then making hundreds of millions of dollars. So, you know, I wonder when the tipping point is where people start treating this nuts. You know, it seems to be a mixture of business / indie / casual, but I still can't believe, like, when I went to Toy Show, that was a big surprise. It's that everyone, and you know, and they're talking about toys. They're like showing off a Barbie figurine, and persons in a 3-piece suit showing off Barbie. And it was just, I actually wanted to take a picture of that. I should have. You know, it's just something you don't expect to see. But other than that, yeah, the developer rant was okay this year. But I did see the game design challenge, which was absolutely fantastic. Did you guys see that at all?
No.
Am I the only one who saw that? Well, the big one was Steve Maritsky. He from Planet Fallen, Leather Goddess of Phobos and stuff, he actually won. His game was pretty good. He had a sort of a tower defense game, and instead, the challenge was just that design a game that would work with, that you can play with another species, and that, so you can play your game with a dog or a cat or anything, and they would actually have to play with you. And his game was that you would actually have a petri dish, and that you would actually build, and they had a camera that can look in the petri dish, and that you would actually have to build defenses against your invaders, which are germs. So it was like germ warfare, and that using light sources, you could actually create, like, you know, defenses and actually increase or decrease the grow rate of germs. And then as they started to creep across towards your defenses, it would use microwaves to kill the germs. And then his favorite line was, he says, and then through the natural process of selection. Your creatures would automatically level up, the ones that survived, and then you can use them for the next level, and so forth, and so on. And he won. His was by far the funniest. I mean, he is actually a strange guy. Steve is actually kind of a shy guy if you talk to him, but in this challenge, he was very outgoing, very, very loud, very funny, and was cracking jokes left and right. But that was actually one of the better design challenges I saw. But is there anything else you guys saw this GDC that you thought was interesting?
I have an interesting one. Have you heard of a game called Web Wars that's coming out at all?
I've heard of it, but I don't know a lot about it.
I'll give it to you just briefly. Really amazing idea, and I I can't believe that someone hasn't done something like this before. It's a web-based game, happens in a browser. It's made by John Galt Games, and it is a space simulation. It's a space war game, and it is branded with CCP's EVE Online, so it's sort of a spin-off of EVE Online, if you've heard of that one. What you do is you attack web pages as territories and take them over. And what they do is they use the Alexa rating of the page to determine its value, which is then like a resource. So for, say you attack Google, and it's, you know, Google is the biggest page on the internet. And so you, every hour that you hold that page without anybody taking it from you using their spaceships to fly in, you will get money based, you know, virtual money, the virtual currency that will allow you to buy more ships to then extend your empire. And what they did is they built a Flash overlay that plugs into your browser. There's a little extra browser toolbar that will go in your browser, and you see your ships actually hovering right over the Gaming Steve website, as if you're going to attack Gaming Steve, and then other ships will come in, and every 10 minutes a battle will happen and for that site, and then whoever wins the battle will then own the site and then get the, you know, the recurring virtual revenue from owning that site. And I just thought it was amazing because the whole internet is a potential territory. So if you wanted to play and you wanted to build up a quiet little empire and make a living, you could just go to tons of tiny little blogs. Maybe they only get you, you know, one piece of currency per hour or something, but you're getting something, and you could just, I mean, limitless, right? Or you can go and attack the big ones. You know, you can go after Gaming Steve, you go after Google, you can go after Yahoo and Virtual Worlds. And I just thought it was absolutely brilliant to build that right into a browser and use the internet as the territory that you're fighting for.
How do they make money off of this?
A couple different ways. It's free to play, but the players can purchase, they call it Web Wars cash, and that Web Wars cash will then allow you to get extra modules that will make you more powerful. There's a ship hangar where you can go and view your whole army of ships and buy modules that will maybe increase your income by, say, 5% per hour, or give all of your ships more damage. And then there's also, they're also going to have an advertising tie-in where you can imagine the advertising possibilities here. If, oh, the Coke page is more important than the Pepsi page, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a lot of different tie-ins there. But it's free to play with some microtransactions and then advertising angle too.
Wow, that's a good idea. I've been thinking about stuff like that because, you know, I was always thinking there's some way, there's one day someone would figure out a way to sort of make a game out of the internet itself. And they're already kind of, are ways, like, you know, indirectly looking at Alexa, like I like to look and see, well, like how different pages are ranked on, you know, on see how sites are ranked. And it's almost like a game in my own mind. But to actually take that and then turn those rankings into an actual currency that you could then fight over is pretty brilliant. When is that supposed to come out around?
They said definitely this year. And they also said, well, actually, I asked them and they said, of course. This one's branded Space Wars, it's EVE Online, but you can imagine once they build the technology to do this, you change the art assets and you can do a million different things with this.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Did you see anything, Mike? Or
The future of MMOs discussion was really the one that was the highlight of the conference for me. Otherwise, I think the only other thing that kind of really stood out for me was I got to spend a little bit more time with Age of Conan. I'm kind of a big MMO nerd like Brent is. And I guess some of my same reservations for Spell of Warren apply to Conan because I'm a jaded person now. It's obviously much, much higher budget than Chronicles of Spellborn is, but I see some of the same problems there where people are aiming for a niche and might be disappointed based on the amount of money they've sunk into it. But
I mean, I actually know some people from there, and I was talking to some of the ex-employees of Funcom, and, you know, the guys who own it, they're big Conan fans, and in fact, they really wanted Anarchy Online to be an M-rated game. They went through a lot of trouble. They didn't quite get it. In fact, rumors, I heard that they were actually disappointed that was not M-rated. And I don't quite understand this. It's like, why would you want to limit your audience? I personally think this is going to be a disaster because the M-rated content might work in the short term, but these are games you have to design that will run and work for hundreds, if not thousands of hours. Is the M-rated content going to keep you an extra 100 hours in the game? I don't see it. I don't understand. The Conan world, yes. Okay, the Conan world, I think that's more interesting. But maybe I can see what they're saying. It's like, well, can you have Conan, like the Conan sequel was a PG-13 sequel, which stunk. And I think if they made that, which is ironic because the Robert Jordan book that that movie is based on is actually a fantastic book. And you can kind of see, oh, this is what maybe they thought this was going to be. It was really, you know, blood and gore adventure. But the movie turned out to be very, very bad because, you know, it was really, you know, watered down. So I can see that maybe they think, okay, I have to give the R-rated experience into a Conan universe, otherwise it won't, you know, translate correctly. But I don't know. I don't see them adding that much value, adding an M to this game.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic point. I've never heard it phrased quite like that before, and you made a really good point there. I think the combat is probably the only thing this game really has going for it. The way that they've created combat is actually really innovative for the genre. But other than that, it's pretty much your standard by the numbers MMO. I'm sorry, I should say there's a guild building system where you can make a city, and it's actually kind of like being in the middle of an RTS. That's kind of new for the genre too, but it's not different enough. And like you'd said, it's just like with the mature combat, is that going to be enough to keep people in the game for the hundreds and hundreds of hours that they need to make a vibrant community?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I do a lot, and those who listen to the show, is that I kind of compare games a lot to movies, because movies have been around longer, it's an established genre, and you can kind of see how movies work. And one thing until The Passion, Mel Gibson's movie, R-rated movies don't do well. They simply don't. In fact, the number of R-rated movies that broke the $100 million mark was like less than a handful. They just don't do well. The biggest mass, you know, audience movies were always PG and PG-13 movies and G-rated movies, you know, and people think, oh yeah, R-rated movies, but you know what? R-rated movies, by definition, are cutting out a huge portion of the audience. So they usually won't make R-rated movies, and only very, very recently with The Passion and with Wedding Crashers and with 300 is this kind of changing, and this is really new even to Hollywood. But until then, R-rated movies just are, you know, they would make money, but they wouldn't make a huge amount of money, and it was just known. And you got to think with M-rated games. Okay, yeah, I guess you can say, well, Grand Theft Auto and Halo, and they're all M-rated games, and they make gargantuan amounts of money, but they're not MMOs. They're, you know, an MMO is still, except, you know, I'd say it's still a niche. Even with World of Warcraft, I'll say it's kind of a niche. I think World of Warcraft kind of unique, but the people that are going to play this game are not World of Warcraft average players, I think. I think it's going to be people who really want to play this game, and that can't be more than 100,000 people at most, I think.
Yeah. A couple of good points there. You mentioned the thing about the violence and the M ratings and how much of a difference that made. And on another game that everyone thought might be M, Warhammer Online, I interviewed Mark Jacobs from Mythic last year at this show, right after they named it as aiming for teen rating. And a lot of Warhammer players said, whoa, what are you doing? You can't do that to the Warhammer universe. And he told me very straight. He said, it's going to be a dark game. But do you really need to see a beheading 2,000 times? Because that's what you get in an MMO. If it's a 20-hour game and there's beheadings and limbs flying off, you know, it might be kind of cool for a little while. But when it's an MMO and you're going to be seeing that 2,000, 20,000 times, it really doesn't matter. And then on the Conan front, you're right. Michael's right. It's a lot of the more of the same, and I don't think that the violence or the sex that's going to be in that game is going to make a big difference. The combat system is something stretching a little bit for the MMO genre. It's kind of nice. Looks like it's going to be more fun than a lot of, you know, click and stand there MMO combat. And I don't think it's going to have a ton of subs. And you're right about the Warcraft crew. They're not going to jump over to this game very easily. But I do think that for old school MMO veterans like ourselves, I think that might just be the MMO for us. I think we will all enjoy it quite a bit.
I was just going to say that for me, Warhammer is that game. I mean, I play everything, so I'm going to play Conan, I'm sure. But for me, Warhammer is the one in the immediate future that I'm looking forward to try and see if I can take a little time away from World of Warcraft.
Yeah, I mean, I have one of my friends, and he does nothing but MMOs. That's it. That's all he plays. And one thing he does is that, you know, he's really excited about the Conan MMO, but it's been delayed so many times that, you know, he kind of gave up. He actually, last time, you know, when he heard it was delayed one more time, he pre-ordered it like 2 years ago. And he's like, you know what, Steve, I'm looking at Warhammer, because it's like, I can't wait for this thing, but it's just taking forever. I don't hear anything about it. I tried to get into the beta. I couldn't get into the beta. And I think he's getting, you know, he's actually getting, and this is his core audience. These are the people who you're going to have playing this game. So I'm just wondering, you know, is there anyone going to be left by the time this game comes out?
I don't know. MMOs are chronically delayed, right? It's sad, because what it says to me is mismanagement and poor project management. But what are you going to do? I mean, they're big, big projects that take many years and a real long time to make. So, you know, things happen. Things change. When you've got a project that's spanning over years and years, technology is changing as you're doing it. New video cards are coming out, new graphics technologies. It's a big deal. It makes it hard to maybe hit a date when you're trying to plan something out for 5 years.
So Mike actually has to go, because he's putting on his coat and he has a bag. So I imagine you're leaving somewhere, Mike.
Yeah, I'm actually heading to San Jose on the BART right now. So I gotta go catch a train. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure. So we'll wrap this up. And Mike, was there anything else you saw that you thought was pretty cool?
There's one talk I want to plug, because I thought it was really clever and it's probably overlooked. And it was called Treat Me Like a Lover by a woman from the UK named Margaret Robertson. And she drew this analogy. I know you're giving me this look like you're horrified, but it was really clever. She drew this analogy between a player's relationship in a game and to romantic partners. And she said, you know, there's this initial phase, you're all excited and everything's new and you're looking at visuals. And then after a while, you need something more substantive. And, you know, so the game's responsibility after the, you know, it's dazzled you with the graphics is to come up with some changing, interesting new rewards for gameplay, to acknowledge your progress and not just kind of brush off everything you achieve, and occasionally pressure you a little bit. So like in Brain Age, where they're like, oh, your brain age is terrible, you're ancient and decrepit and probably can't think, you know, there's a little bit of an element of challenge, like in a relationship. So I thought this was really witty and clever, and I just, because it was so clever and probably overlooked, I wanted to give it a little bit of a salute.
So was that a crowded talk?
It was actually fairly well attended. I mean, it wasn't a massive mob, but the room was full and people seemed really interested.
What's her background? Do you know? What did she say?
I think she's a producer. She's in the UK. I got the sense it was kind of DS titles or handheld, but don't quote me on that, because I pay attention to those things at the end and the credentials have passed by at that point.
I was just curious. Now, I like those little types of talks where you just don't almost think. One of the best talks I ever saw in my entire history of GDC is someone gave a talk about the Pirates of the Caribbean ride exhibit at like a Disney type theme park, and had nothing to do with like gaming. And I remember everyone loved it, because they showed, like, you know, it was like a 3D experience where you were actually taking real life cannons and shooting them and stuff. And I remember hearing people left it. It says, wow, that had absolutely no practical means whatsoever, but that was a fantastic talk. And those are the type of talks I love to see. Unfortunately, I didn't get to see too many of those this year. In fact, this was kind of a weird GDC. It's like every single year it seems bigger and bigger and bigger, but this year I don't know, it seemed actually smaller. And I actually heard it actually might have been smaller. I mean, it's unofficial, but like last year, one thing is that in the press area, when you went to go to these keynotes, it would be wall-to-wall people, and you'd be sitting, you know, someone would be to your left and your right. But this one, I'd have an entire row to myself. It definitely seemed a lot less attended.
The reason for the press thing was they definitely did scale back the press con quite a bit this year. I understand that they overshot a little last year, and so they wanted to scale it back. And as far as attendees, yeah, I think you're right. It might have been a little smaller. It wasn't quite as crowded getting around as it was, but it wasn't by any means hugely shrunken or anything like that. The one thing I noticed is that I saw a lot of repetition in subjects, and I've noticed this over the last few conferences, not just GDC, but also Austin Game Conference, is that there are a few talks that seem to go on forever, and they're being repeated again and again. And I understand that some of them change and evolve over time, but it's the same person giving the same talk over and over and over again. In fact, we sort of made a joke, and I won't mention which panel it was, but we saw this panel, and I had four of my podcasting crew sitting there. We watched it, and we were like, this is really interesting. We should talk about this later. And one of the guys said, what are you talking about? We've been talking about this for 2 years, right? Because it was sort of felt like a rehash to us, especially as podcasters. We sit around and talk about these things all the time.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing I you go to this thing for 10 years and you see the same topics, you see the same things being talked about over and over again, and in a weird way it almost becomes like, oh wow, I really want to see that person talk, even though they're talking about something you've heard before. It really becomes about the personalities. And Dave Jaffe, actually, I forgot, he canceled his talk because he was sick, and I heard a lot of rumbling because I heard his replacement wasn't quite as good. But so actually in a good way I missed that talk, because I forgot that Dave wasn't going to be here. But you know, overall, I thought the lineup of presenters was pretty good. I was, you know, it's starting to become almost like a routine, the GDC. Like you hear the game developers rant every year, game designers rant. You have the game design challenge. You have, you know, the big keynotes. You know, it's sort of becoming almost like something that you can plan out and know exactly who's going to give what at what time. And I guess that's a good slash bad thing. But I will say, once again, if you are looking for a job in the game industry, this is the place you absolutely positively must be. Especially this year, because that the floor, which had the booths, the job fair, was enormous. It used to be like one or two rows. It was like the entire hall this year, and there's no other place to be if you want a job.
Yeah, every single game development studio and publisher was here, and they are looking for pretty much everything. If it is content creation, meaning code creation, art creation, music creation, not a lot of fringe jobs like IT and so forth. You didn't see a lot of network support or production or sales or anything like that, PR, marketing. None of those jobs seemed to be there. It was all, you know, in the trenches, making code, making music, making art, but not a lot of the fringe things.
Yeah, and also just networking. I mean, I say this all the time. It's like, you got to be here. You know, it's like you will not be able, you know, it's you can change, you know, you can send emails, you can talk to people on the phone, but there's no substitute to, like, meeting these people face-to-face and talking to them. And that is, like, I mean, you being here, I'm being here, you know, it's like, you got to be here, because that is really where the relationships come. And I say that once again, because I know a lot of people listen to the show, want to get into games, and if you want to, you know, you can talk about it and say, oh, yeah, I really want to get into games, but unless you really start doing the work, and I mean, it's hard work, you won't get anywhere.
And it's also, as you alluded there, it's about who you know. It's like the rest of life. It's about who you know. And, you know, I'm not necessarily looking for a job in the industry. You know, I do the podcast. I take it very seriously. I have other work that is in the IT world. But people say, are you going to join the job in the game industry? And I say, well, not necessarily. But if I really wanted to, I'd know who to call. And they'd pick up the phone and say, oh, hey, Brent, because they've met me. And that's a very important distinction. So you're right. If somebody wants to get in the industry, doesn't have to be GDC. It could be some of the other ones, one of the smaller ones. But whatever you do, go to them and meet these people.
Yeah, and I can't emphasize that enough. I mean, to me, this has really become almost like a fun place to see people I only get to see once a year. You know, it became something that I used to go to for work to actually learn development procedures, but now it's become something very different for me. And sometimes I kind of lose track of that. But, I mean, Mike, you come here specifically, you know, to learn and, I guess, press the flesh. I mean, what did you think?
Yeah, it's a great networking opportunity. The element of the in-person meeting with people whom you might otherwise have only communicated by email is really important. Certainly, if you're an up-and-coming composer and want to get involved in the game business, you need a good reel, but you also have to start making some face-to-face connections. So this is a very good place to do that.
Yeah, and I know it's expensive, and it's definitely, you know, if you don't live in this area, it's a fairly big commitment to come here, but it is worth it. And also, if you do go to like Carnegie Mellon or DigiPen or one of those places, one of the advantages is they will bring you here. So, you know, and in the past, I would say those like game development degrees were kind of questionable. But in the last few years, especially Carnegie Mellon, little plug there, they really are doing fantastic work. And if you go to these places, you will get hired, or you will be very, very seriously considered.
Key example would be the team that made Portal. Yep. They were hired directly out of school. I don't know what school they went to, but
DigiPen,
was it DigiPen? I forget. I read it. But Valve showed up at their school's demo day where they had all the senior projects showing, and Valve said, come see us. They went. They went and saw them. You're hired. And the whole team.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And now with the, after seeing what Portal did and how well it was received, you know, students, I mean, this is the best time to get into industry if you're, like, trying to break in. You know, students' work will be treated very seriously. But what about composers? What about, like, sort of the offshoots of people are trying to get in, trying to do something? Because you don't hear about, composition as much. You don't hear about that. But, you know, there's got to be people out there that do that would be interested.
Well, certainly, if you know, if you're a freelancer, it's a great opportunity to meet people, meet developers. You go to a talk, and you're sitting next to a developer, and you introduce yourself. You know, composers is a high crank factor, so you need to distinguish yourself from the masses of people who want to get in the business. So by showing up and seeing knowledgeable and easy to get along with, and then handing someone, you know, either a CD or a link to your website where your music samples are, you'll be very well positioned. You know, if your music is supplemented by good memory of you as a person. People, especially if you're going to be working remotely with someone most of the time, which often happens with freelancers. And for in-house audio guys, you know, it's like any other job. It's a position they have to fill. And if they get an impression of you in person as someone who could handle an employee position and could maybe do something managerial, that'll be much more powerful than just an anonymous resume emailed. And, you know, the job fair is then a good place to go. So, yeah, I think it's a good place.
Yeah, and... Well, I'll tell you right now, I'm like freezing because they have the air conditioning on. There's like three people in here, so the person to air conditioning ratio is totally out of whack here. So I don't know. Maybe we should wrap up. Is there anything you wanted to say, Brent?
I think that Mike should make a podcast because he's got a great voice.
Yeah, he should do voiceovers and podcasts and everything else, but he has no time.
That's too bad. So I'm gonna have to maybe get you to do a little bumper for me or something. Say, I'm Mike with the great voice.
What I love about this is that I now have evidence of that offer, so I can play it back for him later when he regrets it.
No. I think that I won't go on and on, but I just think Mike is a natural for podcasting.
No, I agree. So, Mike, what's the name of your podcast?
It's called The When Am I Going to Do This? I'm So Busy with Music Show.
Don't you mean MikeMusic.com?
Yes, MikeMusic.com. Please go there and hire me often.
I do have one other real thing to say since we're wrapping up is I want to thank you, Steve, for having me on the show because it is certainly an honor seeing that you are one of the key, if not the key reason that I started podcasting. I listened to you a lot. I started listening to you when you did the GDC podcast years ago. I said, that's pretty cool. And the nicest thing about it was that you proved that you can do a one-man show and it works. And that's what was holding me back. And when I heard your show, I went, this guy does it and it works just fine. And so I thought about it for a while and I went out and did it. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. And I listened to your show. And you have a good voice too. You're like a natural for this. And the next thing I know is that you have a podcast empire. I still have my one little show and you're like, oh yeah, I'm going on to my 20th.
Yeah, we've added a lot. I got this idea to have more podcasts on the website because a lot of people ask me about podcasting. I'm sure they ask you as well. And I always try to do my very best to help people learn about what it is and how to do it and how they should approach it and the technology. And so finally, I made a podcast that was about making just one show that was all about making a podcast. And people started listening to that and they started contacting me. And I said, you know, all these people are contacting me and they're saying they want to make a show about this game or that game. And I'm thinking, well, why don't I just help them do all of it? And so I said, hey, I'll just host the shows and they own all the content, you know, and we've got 13 great podcasts and on the, we call it The Collective. And it's fun, and it's, and again, Steve, you were responsible for that in a large way.
Wow, I don't know what to say. So where's my royalties?
If we had any money, you'd get maybe a little, you know, gift or something like that, but we have no money.
I know, but I'm only kidding, sort of. Mike, you have anything to say?
Well, I thought I'd do a live version of the gaming theme, Steve, bumper, for a rare performance here, if you'd like it.
Yes, please.
Well, I can't really sing, so that'll make it even better. Gaming Steve! Sorry, I had to change key because I can't really sing in the right key. I hope you appreciate that. This will haunt me to the end of my days.
You know what? I mean, you laugh, but it's like I get a lot of comments on that opening. I know people, there's like two schools of thought, people who absolutely love it and people who absolutely hate it. But the people who seem to hate it listen to the show, so it seems to have worked.
I just like to address the people who hate the podcast theme song because I've read your postings on the forums and you're wrong. That's all.
Yeah, and you know what? I need to get some more bumpers on my podcast opening and closing because I have those great ones, but I've kind of gone through them about 15 times by now. I need to get some procedurally generated content for those. So can you get on that, Mike?
Yeah, we can get a voice simulator so it'll sound like one of those robot voices and it'll come up with a new phrase each time.
Actually, yeah, it can sound like GLaDOS from Portal. That'd be great.
Yeah, that would be. We'll get right on that.
So I wonder if I can get her. That'd be awesome. So, all right, Brent. Yeah, no, it was a pleasure to have you on the show. Last year we met each other for the first time, but I didn't have a chance to get you on. But I'm glad I was able to pull myself away from WonderCom, which is right across the street, which was actually pretty cool. If you're into comic books, definitely check that out. And Mike, of course, actually was surprised. I didn't even know you were going to be here. We just bumped into each other at one talk. So something else that's nice about Game Developers Conference is that you bump into old friends, especially once you get into the industry. So thanks a lot for being on the show. And I will see you guys at, well, probably next year, I imagine.
Yes, next year for sure.
And hopefully I'll see you before that, Mike.
Very likely.
So once again, thanks, guys. And this is Gaming Steve signing off from Game Developers Conference 2008.
Listening to Gaming Steve. Until next week, remember to always finish him!